Hello, welcome to the European History Podcast. My name is Daniel. If you like the series, you can follow us on Facebook at the European History Podcast. You can please subscribe on iTunes. And if you have any questions or corrections, you can always email me at theeuropeanhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Today I'm going to start with Roman history and hopefully take you from kind of the prehistorical trends and achievements of Italian culture all the way through the establishment of the monarchies and the Roman Republic and its government systems, and conclude today's episode with the Roman Republic's domination, growing domination of the entire Mediterranean coastal world with the victories of the Punic Wars and the Macedonian Wars in the Eastern Mediterranean. So, going to cover a lot of ground. The Italian civilization developed comparatively late compared with the Egyptians, the Persians, the Greeks, with the agricultural revolution on the Italian peninsula being observed only around 2500 BCE, the use of bronze around 1500 BCE, and iron by about 800. Outside peoples such as the Umbrians, the Latins, and Etruscans entered Italy from across the Adriatic Sea, and with their superior weaponry technologies and skills, they were able to displace the native inhabitants and establish a agricultural civilization. The Etruscan peoples were the most powerful and influential of these cultures, and they brought agricultural settlement, civilization. They emerged in present-day Tuscany and at first lived under a monarchical and city-state structure of government. A loose confederation of 12 settlements shared religious beliefs eventually replaced their kings with an aristocratic oligarchy, or a council of nobles who would elect executive magistrates to govern the native peoples in farming, mining, and organizing infantry for Etruscan armies when they were needed. Basic economic trade developed and flourished with Carthage and Greece. The Etruscan religious beliefs were polytheistic, as usual, and they focused on kind of a spiritual world with the kind of not necessarily human forms. And their religion was focused on pleasing these spirits, which were often, you know, malicious and evil. And they would please them with either sacrifices or also precise rituals. But later, the Etruscans would start to come in contact with and adopt Greek mythologies, and they started to view gods in human forms like the Greeks, and many with very similar kind of backstories for their Greek gods. And we can see this kind of cultural meeting. If you recall from our Greek episodes, the experience of Greek city-states having overpopulation, which forced that Greek colonization that we talked about. Well, some of those Greek colonies were in southern Italy and Sicily, and so the Italian residents are coming into contact with Greek culture in that way for this reason. And so now we're seeing it from this other cultural perspective. Talking about culture, Etruscan women played significant roles, more so than in Greece, in public and religious festivals. Women were often literate. They participated in athletic competitions like men did. They would also be able to be spectators of athletical events, sitting side by side with men. Graves were marked with both the person's mother and father. Etruscan art often depicts many instances of husbands and wives in respectful manners. Etruscan military adventures were powerful but not coordinated among the city-states, and they did not last very long. Celtic tribes from Gaul moved into the Italian peninsula around 400 BCE, and Etruscan independence and culture went into the decline. However, its influence on the emerging Roman culture will remain significant, and we will see the vestiges of these Etruscan practices remain. Rome originally was a small, insignificant town in central Italy. But it was on a strategic river location in the Latinum area before the Etruscans conquered it in the 6th century BCE. Rome developed a monarchy that was technically very powerful, but in practice was very limited with checks and balances. Kings were given legally the power of imperium, and remember that term, the imperium power, which included the right and authority to issue commands, to enforce them with fines, arrests, or physical punishment. Kings tended to be dynastic based on family, but they were elected with the Roman Senate approving a candidate, and a vote of the people in an assembly to approve the choice of who should be king. This basic structure of government checks and balances and separation of powers will continue through the Roman Republic as it develops in the future. And of course, it forms a firm historical foundation for the government values of the West and, in Europe, that will develop as we go through in European history. Now, this government title of imperator will remain as a vestige when Rome develops into an imperial government. The leader of the government when the Republic is destroyed by General Caesar is the emperor. The early kings were technically commanders of the army, chief religious priests, and supreme judges. In practice, however, they were limited by a senate that was at first about 100 leading males, and it grew to about 300. And these were the most powerful men in the Latium region. These senators served for life, just like the king did. And so the king could not just ignore or basically contravene the influence or advice of what the Senate thought was best to do. There was also a curiate assembly of all citizens who were people who could trace lineage through two Roman parents. And they met when called by the king to decide and discuss and approve decisions. Roman family life was dominated by patriarchy, with a male head of each family known as the pater familias. Fathers had officially unlimited powers over their children. They had the right to any profits children made. They had the right to sell children into slavery or even to kill them. Now, of course, you can imagine culturally and communally, these decisions couldn't just be made without, you know, serious consideration of why it was being done, etc. But in terms of the law, what the father had the right to do, he could sell children into slavery or even kill them. Wives did have more freedom than children, but wives were nonetheless still heavily controlled and governed in their lives and affairs by their father at first and later their husband. For whom she would marry, the decision of whom she would marry is controlled, her ability to control her own property and engage in basic business transactions were subject to the approval of a male father or husband. Divorce in early Rome was extremely rare and was always for cause, including the wife's drunkenness. Wealthy Roman women, however, they did tend to have more independence in a different kind of marriage structure that allowed for more independence for a wealthy woman or a wife who comes from a wealthy family. Wives did enjoy prominence, regardless of their wealth, in household affairs as the mater familias. They governed servants and slaves and managed household activity and accounts. And they played a prominent role in a family council and family decision-making. And so while officially and technically and in many instances the father, the head of the family is a male and basically would have the last say, in practice wives were significantly included in family decision-making. Another aspect of Roman culture is clientage. And if you're not familiar with that term, it's very close or close enough for us to consider as patronage. But clientage was a prominent aspect of Roman culture. We understand it probably better as patronage relationships. It would be a wealthier Roman would provide protection and work opportunities for a poorer citizen who would promise to obey and protect the patron when called upon. And so this kind of financial transactional relationship was also given this kind of cultural sanctity. It was like it was considered a moral relationship also, with moral obligations of the patron to the poorer client and vice versa. This relationship became codified in the early Roman law when it was put into the 12 tables, and it helped to solidify the emerging class division between this very small group of patricians and everyone else who would be plebeians or plebeians. Patricians were the small hereditary noble class. They held all of the religious, economic, and political power of Roman society. Plebeians formed, at first, everyone else who were mostly poor and landless. Separation between the two classes was maintained by a strict prohibition on marriage between the classes. A patrician could not marry a plebeian, and vice versa. As time passed, many plebeians became independently very wealthy. However, the struggle for social equality, political government equality, for access to power continued for 200 years. The abusive behavior of the last kings of Rome and to establish a republic is said to have led to the nobles to revolt around the year 509 BCE, resulting in the creation of the Roman Republic. As you can see, this must have been a fairly smooth transition, considering the democratic institutions of the Senate and the Assembly and various practices and limitations on the monarch were already in place and existed. The Constitution of Rome was unwritten and based on laws and customs. This would be used to the advantage of patricians, because the law's not written down, and so you can't know the law by looking at a piece of paper or in a tablet. And the fact that it's not written down means that it could be shifted or interpreted or modified by patricians for patricians, for their economic advantage, for their political power advantage. But in any case, there was an unwritten law and custom. Two patricians would be elected as consuls, who each shared what was called the imperium powers, once held by the former king. Two financial officials were also created and appointed, called quaestors, and they were chosen to assist the consuls with financial affairs. Consuls had the power to lead the army, religious ceremonies, and to serve as judges. They retained some of the ceremonial trappings of royalty, with wearing the purple robe and having an ivory chair, but they were legally and culturally limited. The term of office for the consul was only 1 year. Either consul could veto a decision or action of the other, and so they both of them had to agree with what should be done in order for it to be done. In the city of Rome itself, if you're in the boundaries of the city, any citizen could appeal a death sentence to a popular assembly. After a consul's term ended, the consul joined the Senate for the rest of their lives. And that's obviously a great benefit for a former consul, but it also shaped the office of the consul itself. It encouraged consuls to defer to the Senate's advice and to respect the limitations put on it by the Senate, because every consul knew that they would be joining that institution of the Senate for the rest of their lives. And it was important for them, of course, to create a good relationship as a person with the senators that they're about to become colleagues with. These limitations on the consuls meant that they were not very independent. They didn't have necessarily a lot of initiative or ambition in their office. This led to problems mostly in terms of military issues or security threats. And the solution was to allow consuls to appoint what was called a dictator to lead the army for up to 6 months in the field when decisive action was necessary. Military campaigns that lasted longer and further from home became more common, and this led to the establishment of an office that was called the proconsulship around 325 BCE, where the leading consul in battle was extended in power and in time. This office and this tendency will become the seed of the Republic's destruction when General Caesar establishes the empire. Other offices developed in the Roman Republic, including that of the censor, who who was responsible for not only counting the citizens of Rome, like we have the U.S. census here, but also determining the class membership of each citizen, the status that they have, and the taxation rate they would be assigned. So the power of the office of the censor grew to the extent that the censor could strike senators from membership in the Senate for either financial or moral reasons. So this office becomes incredibly powerful. It makes the censors a kind of a moral Supreme Court judge. With such power, censors were often very well-respected and very well-trusted former consuls. And by trust, we mean they were trusted, you know, not to basically ruin the lives of other powerful Romans. The most powerful popular assembly, or democratic assembly, if you want to call it that, was the Centuriate Assembly, which was made up basically of Roman soldiers. They elected the consuls, and they heard appeals from citizens who faced a loss of life or property. The Senate, however, still maintained great informal influence over decisions that the Centuriate Assembly would make. The Roman government becomes more complicated moving on. So I guess to circle back very quickly, so you have consuls. You have two consuls who are basically kind of the president and head judge and military leaders. You have the Roman Senate that the consuls would join after 1 year in office. You have some assistants, the praetors and quaestors, with financial affairs. And you have the special growing office of the censor, who would kind of maintain the social status and social divisions of the people of Rome. And what we're going to see coming in this part is just a matter of history, social history, making the Roman government more and more complicated, just kind of organically. And so it gets very messy. Every time I teach this during the year, teaching about the structure of the Roman government is a big mess. And it's just a matter of history. Things are done to try to make people have more equality. So, the Roman government becomes more complicated as a direct result of class struggle from the plebeians versus the patricians. The struggle of the orders is the term that refers to a 200-year fight for this kind of social progress. Plebeians were needed for military campaigns, and they wisely used that value as leverage for the social changes they wanted. 1 year, the plebeians, they marched out of Rome, and they marched up into a hill, and they announced basically the plebeian assembly, claiming legislative power and sovereignty over all plebeians. They elected a tribune, a person, to protect their interests, promising death to anyone who touched the tribune of the pleb. And so the lower, the underclass of Romans, which is most Romans, are basically establishing kind of this government within the government. And this tribune, this plebeian assembly and the tribunes are going to eventually become incorporated, just kind of added on to the existing Roman institutions. So some victories that the plebeians achieved over this 200-year period. The laws of Rome were written down in the 12 tables around 450 BCE and a couple of decades going forward from that. And so now, restricting the ability, as I said before, of the patricians to kind of fudge the interpretation and kind of drift traditional customs to maintain their own advantages and benefits. The plebeians gained the right to marry patricians in 445. Plebeians could be elected consuls by 367. In 300, they first became chief priests. And in 287, laws that were passed by that plebeian assembly became law for everyone. It became binding on all Romans, including the patricians. On paper, this all looks really nice. On paper, this looks like emerging social equality. And in a way, I can see, yes, it is. But in reality behind it, if you look at what plebeians are able to gain these offices, to become consuls, to become the chief priest, to become the tribune of the plebs, this is all organic social and cultural change that in effect makes government power in Rome more complicated, but it, in a lot of ways, it remains the same. these plebeians who gain office and influence are going to be wealthy plebeians. You have two consuls to exercise executive power. Just to review a bit here, they are assisted by these temporary dictators when the military threat requires it. You have these financial quaestor accountants. You have praetors. You have censors. You have the Roman Senate to pass laws and give advice. You have an assembly of soldiers to elect the consuls and hear the appeals. And now you have a plebeian assembly that also makes laws and also has legislative powers. And so this is the chaos of Roman government. In actual practice, however, as I said, power, law, and decisions continue to be made by the same kind of people, wealthy people, powerful people, regardless of whether they were plebeians and patricians anymore. There was no secret ballot in legislative voting, and therefore votes were easily bribed, bought, intimidated, blackmailed by the people with money and influence. From 233 to 133 BCE, for example, the consulship offices were held by a member of the same 10 families 50% of the time. And so we see that with these structural changes, the same nature of who has power remains the same: people with power and money. The Roman Republic also saw dramatic territorial expansion. So going out from the government, what's going on with Roman kind of military foreign achievement? The Roman Republic saw dramatic territorial expansion in this time that served the purpose of stabilizing the Italian peninsula politically and culturally, providing opportunity and kind of a buy-in for the poor outside of Rome who became paid or professional soldiers, and creating allies out of the tribes they defeated on the Italian peninsula. The Etruscans were finally defeated in Latium in 392. The Latin League was defeated in 338. The Samnite tribe was defeated in 295. Pyrrhus the Greek was defeated in 275, until all of South Italy was ruled by the Roman Republic by 265 BCE. Pyrrhus the Greek gives us the phrase of a Pyrrhic victory. It occurs to two occasions where Pyrrhus' army defeats the Romans in battle. And it's called a Pyrrhic victory because he defeated them at huge cost. And he did not obviously have the same resources as Rome did on the Italian peninsula. And so it's when you're going up against someone and you technically beat them on two occasions, but it takes literally everything you have. And so you know you can't keep going on like that. You will not keep winning, and you're going to end up losing if you have victories that way. And so he has these Pyrrhic victories, but he is ultimately defeated in 275. After all of these cultural groups are defeated, treaties after those defeats often secured and strengthened and consolidated Roman power. Going outside of Italy, Carthage was a city-state that was established in the 9th century BCE, so rewinding the clock, back to 9th century BCE by the Phoenicians, but it was left to become an independent city-state when Phoenicia was conquered by the Assyrians and Persians in the 6th century. The Carthaginians expanded to cover the North African coast and most of the Iberian Peninsula, which is now where Spain and Portugal are. When Carthage agreed to send a garrison to Sicily to assist some Italians who were resisting Hiero, who was the tyrant of the city of Syracuse in Sicily, this began a proxy conflict, and grew into the First Punic War against the Romans. The Roman Senate got word that the Carthaginians were going to Sicily, and the Senate agreed to send a Roman army to Sicily to expel the Punic garrison. It's called the Punic Wars because in Rome, the Carthaginians were referred to as the Phoenicians, and in Latin, that is Punis or Punic. And so when the Carthaginians, that's the same as the Punics, I guess. So this leads to the First Punic War. The First Punic War lasts from 264 to 241. And to make it short, the Romans won with a naval blockade and a siege that the Carthaginians couldn't break. And peace terms included Carthage agreeing to give up Sicily and smaller islands, and promising an indemnity payment to Rome over 10 years. This could have established a long-term peace. However, Carthage faced a rebellion, an internal rebellion soon after, and Rome took advantage by taking the other two major islands in the Mediterranean, Corsica and Sardinia, and demanding another indemnity, additional indemnity payment from Carthage to maintain the peace. Rome put governors in place for Sicily, Corsica, and Sardinia, and their, quote, imperium was not limited. It was in no way checked or restricted like officials, government officials were on the Italian mainland. The islanders were not granted citizenship, but they were mere subjects to pay a tribute, with great wealth opportunity for whomever became tax collector. Rome was later distracted by Gallic conflicts, allowing Carthage to regroup and expand into Spain. The Punic army chose Hannibal as its leader at the age of 25 after the former king was assassinated. And when a Spanish town asked for a Roman alliance, and it was granted by Rome, this precipitated the Second Punic War, when conflict inevitably broke out in Spain between Carthage-allied towns and the Roman-allied town. Carthage and Hannibal defeated the Roman army in multiple battles, stunning the Romans until the Romans elected Quintus Maximus as a dictator to kind of take over the military effort. Quintus tried to avoid direct confrontation in favor of a guerrilla-style ambush and harassment of the Carthaginian army. In 216, the entire Roman army was caught, pushed into battle, and virtually wiped out at the Battle of Cannae. I'm not sure if that's the right pronunciation. It was the worst defeat in Roman history, though. Most Roman allies at that point switched sides, they abandoned Rome and sided with Carthage, and Rome would not engage in any battle, major battle, for 10 years. Romans then appointed Publius Cornelius Scipio, he shows up in the Italian national anthem, by the way, as the pre-consular of Spain. He was also 25. He quickly conquered the peninsula. In 204 BCE, he landed an army in Africa while Hannibal was absent and forced Carthage to accept a peace. But when Hannibal returned, the Carthaginians decided to risk everything at the Battle of Zama in 202. They lost. Carthage was reduced to a dependent ally for Rome, and Rome became the dominant power of the entire Mediterranean coast west of Italy. Looking to the Eastern Mediterranean and the Hellenistic world, the Romans gained increasing dominance with a series of three Macedonian wars between the years 215 and 168 BCE. Roman governing attitude toward defeated peoples around the Mediterranean, from Spain to Greece, became more and more profit-driven, more harsh, less kind of long-term ally and peace-focused. This culminated with the destruction of Carthage in the year 146 due to a very technical breach of their peace treaty. And I'll stop there. When we come into the next episode, I want to talk about the civilization in the early republic. We're going to talk about some more of the kind of the details of Roman religion. I want to talk about the education system, the institution of slavery. We're going to get into the destruction of the Republic with Caesar, the Gracchi, Marius, and Sulla, and we'll go all the way through the fall of the Republic and the triumph of Octavian. Thank you for listening. This is the European History Podcast. If you like the series, you can subscribe on iTunes, and if you have a question, you can email at theeuropeanhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Please also like us on Facebook at the European History Podcast. See you next time. My name is Daniel.